If you want to fly, you got to give up the things that hold you down. Toni Morrison.
What is my social life going to look like? How can I go out and not drink? What will people think of me? Well, I won't be cool anymore. What the fuck is it going to look like? You know, now I view it as a strength.
Welcome to the Breaking Bias podcast, the show where we explore the stories and experiences of people from all walks of life. We are on a mission to inspire new thoughts and dialogue in an effort to challenge bias and cultivate connection. I'm your host, Heather, and joining the conversation today is Devanin Serafino. Devanin is, among many things, a U.S. veteran, author, entrepreneur, and host of the podcast Sex, Drugs, and Jesus, Taboo Topics in Troubled Times. Devanin, welcome to the Breaking Bias podcast.
Hello, 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 honey. I am so glad to be here. How are you?
Good. And let me actually just say something about us being here together. I want to call us both out for our persistence. So we were introduced, I don't know if you remember this, we were introduced almost 2 years ago by Mike Oppenheim by email. Shout out to Coffin Talk Podcast, because I heard you on his show. And then I heard you on Emerson Sosa's show, Hear Some Evil. And we have been trying to connect schedules ever since. Almost 2 years. How crazy is that?
Yes. Oh my gosh. Both of those guys are so like hot. I never tell them, you gotta keep it classy. You're like when you're in front of, the boys, you can't let them know everything. But if they hear this, then oh, the fuck well. And so, but yeah, beautiful minds, both of them, you know, Mike and Emerson, beautiful souls and beautiful everything else too.
Oh my gosh. Well, I start every episode by having the guest share with us their, now you write a whole memoir on your life, but I ask the guest to start with what I call their origin story. So really early childhood, some impactful events that you feel really shaped who you became and maybe gave you some of the resilience that you have had to overcome certain things. So can you share with us a little bit about little Devanin growing up?
Little Devanin growing up was molested by his uncle, beat by his dad, and dehumanized and devalued and told things that he's not allowed to like have emotions, like be angry at adults and things like that. Whenever I wasn't soaking my arms in cool towels after being beat with belts and things like that. Whenever dad wasn't cheating on mom and slinging his dick all over town. And I think that those things, hashtag narcissism. And I think that, you know, those things really helped to build character, you know, going to school and all of that. Great, wonderful. But the real strength comes from the adversity. You know, and I feel like that's at any age, you know, and so especially once we get to a point where we can understand, you know, what happened, why it happened, not be bitter about it. So no glossy upbringing. I was raised in the hood, crack houses everywhere, waking up to bullet holes in the walls, syringes floating down the street whenever it rained and flooded, you know, that type of thing.
So that's where your resilience came from. You had to. Wow. So I mean, kind of on that note, I just actually finished your book. So the Sex, Drugs, and Jesus, a memoir of self-destruction and resurrection. So first of all, before we get into your part of this, throughout the whole listen, I'm like, Lorenzo, is he okay? Should we send help? Do you know if he's fine?
You know what? The kids are all right. Okay. The kids are all right right now. They're all right right now. You know, I've probably spent, it feels like, about half of the recent years in mental hospitals. But, you know, it had to happen. When I began to awaken and to deal with all of those issues that I just told you about, it wasn't until like maybe 3 years ago, I went to school to become a licensed hypnotist at the Hypnotist Motivation Institute, and I began to dig around in the mind and the subconscious in a way that I had never done before. It's one thing to watch YouTube videos, it's another thing to go to school, you know, for something or to get like a focused education. And then I started having dreams about my inner child. The first one of those was me in my adult form talking to like my maybe 5 or 7 year old self. in a burning house, which represented our childhood home. There was barely a frame left. The thing was on like red flaming flames all around. And I was talking to my little 5-year-old self, trying to get him the fuck out of this house. He wouldn't move. He was sitting on the ground with his knees in his chest crying. And I kept telling him, you know, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. So for whatever, you know, for all of those things that had happened when I was, you know, younger, my inner child interpreted it, the molestation and the abuse, as being his fault. And he would rather stay in a house that's on fire than to get out and leave, because he was so stuck by those emotions. And that's how that began to unravel, when I began to dig for it. So imagine living life 30, 40 years on the earth with that type of thing affecting you from your subconscious, and you don't know it's there.
Yeah, it's wild to think about. And really, you were very, you know, with the book, you were amazingly transparent. I feel like that has to take a lot of courage to tell some of the stories that you tell, because oftentimes I think we have this kind of, oh, self-preservation. This story maybe doesn't make me look the best, so let's not share it. And you're just like, fuck it, lay it all out there. Was that a cathartic experience for you?
It was surprisingly cathartic. I did not write my book, that being the first one, for the purpose of catharsis. It was because I got delivered from so many dangerous situations that I was in, that I felt like it was my obligation to give a written testament. This is the gospel according to Devan and Serafino, you know, in a way that people will be able to benefit from permanently, as long as this earth spins. So there's a podcast, there's the book, Sex, Drugs, and Jesus, the name of both of them, because I didn't, just standing up and testifying in church on Sunday wasn't going to cut it. I don't go to church anymore, because I found Jesus outside of church much better than I did in church. And so sometimes you got to write it out. You can get more detailed, and then people can pick what they want. You know, if they want to, if they can identify with the shooting up drugs part, great. If they want to identify with the, you know, with the sex with the guys and the cum falling out of your ass, you know, they can identify with that. If they want to identify with running from the police or being locked up in the damn jail with all the damn petty ass queens throwing shade and all the things that they do, you know, that way people can read through it. And then the same person might read through something at, say, at age 20 and identify with one part and pick that same book up again at age 30 and need a different part. And so that's why I wanted to write it out. I went through such embarrassing things being homeless in Houston that whatever pride was left was gone. So I didn't mind writing it all and telling it. People over at, say, like Kirkus Reviews, though, which I don't know that I would recommend them if your book is too real. You know, those big time reviewers like a certain type of book that's rather polished, conservative, a little grungy, you know, a little grungy, but not too much. But I'm like, no, the shit's real. You know, I didn't really feel like they gave me the best review, though I did send it over there to them. So to answer your question, sorry for the rabbit hole, but no, transparency comes very easily to me. I don't give a fuck what anybody thinks. Well, there was a time that I did, and I was super self-conscious and super insecure and super people-pleasy. And basically, if you're not the Trinity, being God, Jesus, or the Holy Ghost, I could give a fuck less what you think. I mean, I love you, but also fuck you.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, it's funny because you pulled out a couple, like several different areas of like what people might connect with or resonate with. And I don't know if that's the right term to use for what I'm about to say, but throughout the book, like right from the beginning, it became evident to me anyways that you have this characteristic about you that I would say many people would wish that they had, which I would say is like a persistence and assuredness and willing to sacrifice comfort for what you want. Now, that went in not so great ways in sometimes, but there's also like right from the start, right, where you're saving your lunch money. So you're foregoing that lunch so that you can save up for these, you know, pants that you really wanted. And then, you know, your time as a recruiter, just like killing those numbers and just getting out on top in terms of success. Just where does that come from, do you think? Or do you know?
I think that it all started when my mother was pregnant with me. You know, whenever a woman is pregnant with a child, that kid gets exposed to whatever the mother goes through. You cannot separate the two. The kid's experience is the mother's experience, period. And so if she's operating in low vibrations, a kid's going to be having a low vibrational time while they're in the oven, you know. But if she's elevated and hanging around with high vibrations, well, there you go. Well, when mom was pregnant with me, a narcissistic dad, her fuckboy husband, you know, was out there running around slinging dick as he does. And so mom had to deal with all of those emotions of betrayal and trying to track down, you know, who he's with, where he's going, and all that foolishness. She did. She persevered. And she was able to still carry me to term, you know. And it's very stressful because a woman is in a very precarious situation when she's with child, and even more so when she's giving birth. And I think that I was born into that narcissistic cycle from that, but also I gained, you know, my mother's resiliency as well at that same time. So y'all, I'm going to give a shout out to my rave people, because I just moved to New York 4 months ago. The rave scene is like damn near every night here, especially over in Brooklyn. And so Jinko Jeans, back from Hot Topic, back when Gadzooks, Spencer Gifts, you know, Hot Topic, you know, you swing by the mall, pick up your mood rings, get you some kickwear, Jinko, J-N-C-O, jeans. These were Sidewinders. That there was the black ones and the blue ones, the diamonds. Like the Arizona Diamondbacks or the Diamondback Snake going up the side. They were like $60, $70 each. And mom was like, hail to the no. I'm not paying for that bullshit. And I was like, well, I'll starve, damn it, but I'm gonna look cute. And so who needs food when I need fashion? And so not promoting anorexia, believe me, any. I'm not promoting starvation, but, you know, we do what we must. And so that's what she's referencing. And so it's no surprise I grew up to get into fashion, you know, owning Down Under Apparel or my lingerie store like I do, because I had a passion for fashion back in the day. But resiliency came from, you know, benefiting from my mother's struggles when she was carrying me.
I want to talk a little bit about the substance challenges, just because it's something that I think a lot of people fall into a lot more easily than the outsiders would like to admit. So, and at the beginning, actually, you described, you know, kind of your starting point in Houston, where many times people would offer and you would turn them down because it's just, you just knew that's just not something that was interesting to you. And then eventually, as you share explicitly in the book, you know, you said yes, which turned into a whirlwind journey. When you're thinking back to, I mean, I guess this is maybe a tall ask, but if you think back to that time of when you finally just said, fuck it, yes, do you remember what contributing factors might have led to that? Was it just like finally the pressure kicked in? Was it because other things were kind of kicking you down in life at that point?
It was a combination of the sneaky little devils lurking around in my background, which I mentioned, you know, the abuse and molestation and not having dealt with those things or realizing they were issues that needed to be dealt with, along with being kicked out of the church for not being straight. And so this was a cleverly crafted plan by the powers of darkness to destroy me, because if I don't want to do something, I'm not going to do it. But if I am hurt, if I'm feeling like I need to patch over a wound and not realizing that's what I'm doing, if I've lost my community, i.e. the church community, not realizing that people are very tribal and will always seek some sort of community, I didn't realize what I was doing while I was doing it. So I'm serving at Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas. This is the largest mega church in the country, one of the biggest in the world. This is Joel Osteen Ministries, blah, blah, blah. I'm volunteering. They find out I'm queer and hanging out in Montrose in the gay district, and they call me in to fire me from volunteering, not for showing up late, not for not doing the volunteer work, but because of who I am, how they perceive me to be outside of church. So this devastated me. And yes, I always like to throw shade at Joel Osteen for hanging out with Kanye West, who is not who we want our kids to grow up to be. And yet, you know, publicly on stage and endorsing Kanye West, but firing his volunteers behind the scenes for going to the club on the weekends and dancing to Kanye West music, mind you. And so this is an example of religious trauma. When someone volunteers at a church, that is like the thing that ties you to that church. You have all these options. this is your community within that large ass community, thousands of people. You can't be friends with every damn body there. So you find your group. So when they ripped that away from me, it ripped my community, my sense of family. I had got out of the military, left all of that, left California, moved to Texas, and immediately got synced in with Lakewood. This is like 2-3 years later. I'm fired from there after getting all these volunteer awards and recognition. I had applied to be on staff there. Instead of getting offered a job, I was given a pink slip for being queer. And this was after they questioned who I was dating and all of this and being concerned about the shoes I was wearing because the parents were complaining. Shade to the petty ass parents at these big churches with enough money and enough spiritual arrogance to complain about the free help in their attire when they're not paying for any clothes for the volunteers, just complaining about what they're wearing. And that hurt me in a way that I didn't realize. When trauma comes, it doesn't feel like apparent pain. It cut me so deep that I didn't feel any fucking thing. And that is the worst type of pain, that trauma, because it's like a cut limb. If you cut too deep, it'll bleed everywhere, but it cuts the nerve so you don't even feel it and you don't understand that you're bleeding out. It works the same way for mental breaks, emotional breaks. Like when someone has a mental break, they don't, and I've had this before, you just don't feel any damn thing. And you know, and you just start having all this crazy sex and you're doing all these drugs and shit. And to the outside, it looks like you're just partying and having the time of your life. And I was miserable as fuck. So I started saying yes to drugs because I was like, you know, fuck this. You know, the church doesn't want me. I can go into this club and be accepted and nobody's going to kick me out for who I'm dating or what I'm doing when I'm not here, as long as I don't bring negative energy into the space. That should be all that matters. The nightlife became my new church. And along with that came the boys, came the drugs, came the new family. It was just as treacherous as the church. Both were fake. Both were there to use me for whatever they could get. And neither one had my best interests in mind. But that's where it came from. Trying to heal that church fracture by patching it over with an even worse, well, a similarly worse solution.
I mean, and just to emphasize here too, because you said, you know, you were a volunteer, but it's not just that you were a volunteer. Like, you were loyal and dedicated and like what sounded like a complete promoter of all things for the time that you were there. I think that makes it hurt even worse is all of the time and effort that you spent, and just to be like, oh no, sorry, we don't like you anymore because of this. Really? Yeah.
Oh, they weren't classy enough to give us sorry.
No, they wouldn't, because it's not, that would be an admission that it's ridiculous. And I think arrogance, you think you use that term arrogance. I couldn't agree more that I think that that's what it is. It's religious arrogance. There's no way that they're going to admit wrongdoing because they're righteous in their minds, whether it makes sense or not. Ugh. Do you still struggle with substance or?
Oh, I'll answer your substance question, but if I may, I'll take like a minute or five here to just kind of draw the parallel. So yeah. What I encountered at Lakewood Church is something that's prevalent in the religious community, which is like this religious narcissism. And narcissism is any sort of individual who has no empathy, only concerned about their own agenda, yet in their minds rationalize it and make it make sense, and they view themselves as the good person. So when I got kicked out of there, they were offended that I would dare have a personal life that goes against their belief system. That's why they offered me the conversion therapy package that I rejected. You know, a narcissist wants people in their life on their terms, the way they want it. They don't give a damn about that other person's freedoms and options. Being born into the narcissistic cycle through the abuse of my dad, which segued into the abuse from the uncle, of course, the straight uncle, of course. And, you know, that put me in the narcissistic cycle of dating narcissistic, cheating dudes, and also accepting abuse from the church and any sort of narcissistic thing. The energy, the spirit presents itself both through organizations and individual people, friends, frenemies, all of those things. Having been snapped out of this by the last relationship that I was in and coming into the knowledge of the cycle that I was in, made it all make sense from birth up to that last relationship. That same narcissistic energy showed up everywhere I went because it was operating from within me from those unresolved childhood wounds. I stopped doing I stopped drinking alcohol. I stopped crystal meth. I stopped cocaine, and I stopped smoking crack and shooting up crack and all and shooting up meth and all of those things. I do hallucinogenic because of the healing things in that. I'm getting ready to go to Mexico to do a 1 week ayahuasca intensive. I do ketamine, MDMA, ecstasy, GHB, anything in the 2CB, you know, anything in the psychedelic sphere. So in hypnotherapy, you know, I learned we never want to take something away from somebody without replacing it. So I gave up those four things, alcohol, crack, crystal meth, and cocaine, but we want to switch over into, you know, and I'll do my CBD gummies and shit like that, you know, so let's get into something else, you know, to answer your question.
Okay, so that's a really fascinating way to look at it. And first of all, I love this hallucinogenic journey. I've started to dive a little bit into the studies and things like that that have been going on with that. And I'm interested. Well, Mike Eops, I don't know if he told you about his ayahuasca, but that's kind of, I heard his story a little bit. And then I had a friend that just recently did it. So I'm excited. Is this going to be your first time with ayahuasca?
Technically, yes. This is in Mexico. The first time, I've only ever done it in Mexico. The first time I did it, the shaman that I was with did not like to use heavy amounts of DMT. So I didn't have the ayahuasca experience that you always hear about with the vomiting and the emotional meltdown. This time I will. This one is through a nonprofit agency known as Heroic Hearts Project. And they exist to send veterans, this is only for military veterans, to Peru and into various parts of Mexico to do ayahuasca. It is 7 days. It's three ayahuasca ceremonies and three temazcal. The temazcal being in the hot sauna that you go in to detox the morning that you're going to do the ayahuasca. It's a 4 week purge period before to include group counselings and one-on-one coaching integrations. No coffee. Got to lay off on the sugar. No bread unless it's homemade. No pasta unless it's homemade. All of that. They monitor sleep schedule and everything. And then once you get back, another 4 weeks of like a debrief. I'm told the visuals will be so heavy my eyes are going to hurt that I'm going to want to sleep for several days after. This ayahuasca experience is going to be the ayahuasca experience of all the ayahuasca experiences. And I will be recording a YouTube video and doing a podcast to talk about it because it's something that is very useful for veterans.
Cannot wait to hear about this, and I really hope that it finds you where it needs to find you and shows you what you need to see. I think this is such a cool thing that's being tapped into now.
The Heroic Hearts Project, also this retreat is going to be their first one specifically for LGBTQIA veterans, and it was sponsored, so we actually don't have to pay anything for it at all. Usually it's a minimum like $500 donation if you get accepted, and you can pay like $10 a month for 50 months. They're not trying to like hunt you down for it or anything, but these are $3,000 to $5,000 retreats, you know, because they're through the nonprofit, but you're not paying for it if you get accepted like that. And so this is their first one just for queer people. So shout out to Heroic Hearts Project.
That's amazing. I like to just touch on this idea of replacement. I've actually heard that from other, actually, I've heard it from someone that was talking about food. So I've never actually really thought about it in relation to, well, I guess maybe I have in relation to drugs, but not in the way that you described it. So I like how intentional that was. Do you feel like that's that kind of intentional decision to replace as opposed to just, you know, cold turkey, nothing? Do you feel like that is really what got you over the hump of doing kind of the self-destructive type drug use?
It was a gradual realization of the fact that alcohol had to leave my life. I had tried to approach all of those drugs, the crack, the crystal meth, the cocaine, from a different angle. You know, if I do it this way, this dose, in this setting, in this country, you know, can I still figure out a way to keep it in my life? Was it really the drugs? It was the community. That same community that I thought was there for me when the church kicked me out all those years ago, it was a phantom lie. You know, I mean, the drugs stopped being fun when I got HIV years ago and thought I was going to die. That's when I started using I mean, when I started using, I was numbing pain and didn't realize it. That was the first time I was conscious. So it was about community. So when we ask somebody or someone is deciding they're going to stop using drugs, it's not just letting the drugs go. It's letting who you perceive to be friends go, who you perceive to be family go. So doing the level of spiritual work that I do now, it is not congruent with even drinking, because I can't have anything in my system that's going to act as a depressant. And alcohol really is a depressant. And it wasn't until I stopped it that I realized that alcohol had its talons in my heart at this whole time, and I didn't know. I came to this realization, this final realization, this last time that I was in the mental hospital up here at the Bronx Veterans Affairs Hospital here, like maybe like a month and a half ago. And I was like, this is not congruent with where I'm at on my spiritual ascension and journey anymore, you know. And it was like God flipped the switch and I got out of there, and I just had to have not wanted alcohol anymore or those drugs anymore. That is, for me, the deliverance that I required. I wasn't going to be in a situation where I want these substances, but I'm stopping myself from using them. I told God, like, you gotta have to take it and take the whole damn thing, the desire and everything. Now, knowing what I know about the replacement theory or replacement fact, because it is what it is, it's just like we treat a baby the same way. If they're crying for that nipple sucky thing, you take that, but you give them a bottle. You don't just take it and leave them with nothing. So I guess on some level, I had enough sense to know that I don't want to avoid there, to run the risk of falling back into those things, even though I don't want them. But it's like now, ever since I got out of the hospital like a month and a half ago, I haven't done any of those substances because I'm delivered from them. But also I could have the weed if I wanted to, or the ketamine, but I have to have none of that in my system for this ayahuasca thing. So even though I'm not doing anything at all but water and juice, I don't feel like I miss the hallucinogenics, because I have to pause that before the ayahuasca, but I also don't miss the alcohol, crack, crystal meth, cocaine either, because I'm totally over it, because God then took that out of me. So it's a process. It was a combination, and I really had to, and I allowed myself, and I really prayed and meditated about this. I allowed myself to not judge myself, but to mourn the loss of alcohol, the loss of crystal meth, the loss of cocaine, the loss of crack. You know, never will I pack a crack pipe again or have those crazy conversations with the other crackheads on the corner, or I will never ever be in the meth house again, and I will never be at a, you know, I will never sit at a bar the same way again. I allowed myself room to be like, you know, I am sad that this is no more. It was once a part of my life, but it's no longer logical for it to stay. And now we're moving on, you know. And I really had to get real and not judge myself and just be like, you know what? It's okay to be sad that I'm not going to be smoking this rock anymore.
I love that. I think that's a level of grace and acceptance that I think is not only fundamental for you or anyone that's experiencing things like this, but also something that a lot of people will just not understand. They won't, because I, from the outside perspective, I think it's really easy for people that haven't struggled with anything like this to say, why don't you just get your shit together? Why don't you just stop? It like as though it's some sort of light switch that you can flip on and off. And as you've mentioned a couple times, it's not that simple. It's not just the substance. There's a lot of components and factors that are driving that continued use. So I really like how you explained how it's giving yourself that grace, that non-judgmental grace of being able to mourn something that at one point was a huge factor in your life, and at one point you enjoyed, at one point it was probably your therapist, all of the things, right? It's okay to mourn that. Yeah, I like how you describe that. I think that's important to kind of get a different perspective on it.
Right. I cried about it. And then I purged that out. And then my perspective was granted the grace to shift. Because when I was struggling with letting alcohol go, which is such a socially accepted thing, even though I now view it as an oppressive matrix that's reinforced by society, I used to be like, oh my gosh, what is my social life going to look like? How can I go out and not drink? What will people think of me? Well, I won't be cool anymore. What the fuck is it going to look like? You know? Now I view it as a strength. You know, because true strength comes in being in the minority, not in the majority. You know, so now I go to the bar, order a mocktail or a glass of water, and understand that I'm one of the most powerful people in the room because I have the strength to come in here and stand in this power and not do what everyone else is doing. I gained a strong advantage by letting alcohol go.
Okay. Okay. I love that. Talk to us about your journey with God and Jesus and organized religion, because that has been a journey. And you've mentioned, you know, you no longer go to church because you found your faith and God outside of church. So, you know, what did faith look like in your darkest hours?
Ooh, well, there has been a lot of darkness. I'm going to explain this in a way that I think can help people. I'm going to say this. The further I get away from church, the closer I get to God. Okay. The church, the concept of church is something that was born during a time, and God kind of struggled with it himself. It's not like he was all giddy about, you know, David building him a temple, but God is super flexible. This needed to happen in a time when the nation of Israel was being set apart from the nations around them, ergo all the rules and things from back in the day. The term Christian and all of that had to do just with the nation of Israel being different. This shit does not apply anymore because everybody can believe in the Lord if they want to. Even back in those days, though, people did not go up to the temple at Jerusalem every Sunday. People worship God personally in their private lives, primarily, and very rarely did they actually get together for feast or community things. That was not the status quo. And that's why they were so special. That yearly trip to the temple was the trip to church once a year, bitch. And, you know, and the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of whatever was just on those special times under those moons. It was not three damn nights a week, you know, and all of this shit and all of these rituals. It wasn't all the time. When people are raised in that and indoctrinated in it, your religion is based on what other people told you, period. Until you learn how to go to God for yourself without a church, without a priest, and how to get into those scriptures and study Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek on your own, then your experience with God is defiled and weakened by a mediator and a human, and it is not as authentic as it could be. It is a cute place to start, but you cannot stay there. Church is a school, in my opinion. You should graduate from that school like every damn where else. If you want to start there, great. But at some point, you got to get off the preacher's titty and get before the Lord for yourself. And otherwise, it's just not being real. You know, you shouldn't be going to church to see Sister Susie and to see the cute girl and boy. I mean, okay, no, that's not what it's about. Some people have made a God out of the community, out of the classes, out of the groups and everything like that. When I reached my darkest hours, you know, I had to be able to go to God for myself or reach out to people like my evangelist Nelson, who I reached to in my talk about in my book, people who know how to get prayers through, you know, not say seven Hail Marys or some shit. I mean, really, you know, get down there and talk to God. It's personal. You know, my relationship with the Trinity is super, super personal through all of these things. You know, I got my first tattoo in Hebrew like last week, you know, because I wanted, you know, something tied directly to the nation of Israel and into God himself on my body. You know, that's how much God means to me. We got to get personal, you know, with it and take the religious structure out of it because it blinds us to the authentic experience of walking with God for our self, interpreting scripture for our self. Anything that you read that was not in the original language, and most of it can be relied upon, but not all of it, is somebody else's interpretation. I also want to tell people that they got to get over being pissed off at God. You know, I, of all people, could sit around and be angry about being hurt by the church or watching other people be hurt by the church. It's not going to work. Okay, you got to forgive them and let fucking go and get your spiritual shit together, because you're not going to always be a human, and we do fucked up shit too. So did the preachers and But still, we all got to forgive and we all got to be forgiven. Otherwise, you're only hurting yourself. It's not going to work when you die and stand before the Lord and be like, well, I stayed mad because of what the preacher did. Okay, they did that, but you are accountable for what you do. So we cannot sit around in this spiritual lethargy of being neither here nor there. It's what the Lord calls lukewarm. You're not hot, you're not cold, you're just kind of ambivalent towards the whole thing. That's not going to work because we chase after everything that we want with such passion: sex, money, dating, travel, trips, children, food, movies, nail salons, hair, for everything. We go after that shit and let a bitch tell us we can't have it. It's going to be some shit. Okay. You know, and now religious education is at your fingertip. There's apps that will interpret Hebrew for you and Aramaic, I mean, in Greek and all of these different things. The knowledge is there if you really want it. You don't need a preacher. You can't stay around being angry over what a church did. Yeah, the church misrepresents God, but you can't let that stop you. How bad do you want to know him? I think about how people go on these hookup apps and shit or dating apps. They don't let a little bit of frustration getting ghosted on there and manipulated stop them. They just keep right on at it until they bust that nut. Now, don't they? You know, so I'm saying all that to say, and I apologize for this tantrum. We go after every goddamn thing we want with pit bull tenacity. We don't let nothing fucking stop us when we value it enough. Do the same thing with your spirituality, because you could have everything you want. God's just going to make sure you have it in the right way, in a balanced way with the right people, as opposed to getting yourself fucked off with trying to do those things with low vibrational people that's going to take you down in life. You can have all the sex, date all the people, make all the money, do all those things I just said, but God's going to shift you in a better direction. You just got to put him first.
So you're essentially, you know, within your faith now, you don't go to church. So you're essentially, and I don't want to say reteaching, but in some ways maybe reteaching yourself by delving deeper into the actual texts as opposed to listening to someone preach about the text, which of course you mentioned and I certainly agree is just their interpretation. Am I understanding that right in terms of how you're practicing your faith now?
Absolutely. It's like if I had a boyfriend or a son, you know, I'm in a personal relationship with them, just like we're in a personal relationship with whatever being. If somebody doesn't believe in the Trinity, okay, call it Ganesh, Shiva, you know, whoever it is you want to worship or believe in, or the universe. You want to get personal with them. You would not let somebody give you secondhand information about your husband, wife, significant other, whatever, however gender they may identify or not, or your kid. You'd be like, move, bitch, get out the way. I'm going to talk to my significant other, my child, directly. I don't need you to know. So, yeah, I removed the middleman. Even in the drug world, when I was a drug dealer, middlemen always cause problems. Extra money, extra fees, extra eyes everywhere. We always want to get rid of the middle bitch. A preacher is a fucking overpaid middleman. Overinflated, on a pedestal they don't belong in. They get in the fucking way. So, yeah, I remove them and I learned for myself, and everybody can do that.
Okay, I love that analogy. The whole, like, if something's going on, you're going to go to the source. Why do we not? Wow, I love that. That's a great way to put it, because it's really, I like to think of things as like mentally tangible. I can grab that, and that makes so much sense to compare it to those situations and implore people. Why are you listening to someone else's opinion of it? Go find out. We have access. There's a lot of access out there. So, I love it. Are you ready for the final three questions?
I am.
So the first one is, the show is Breaking Bias. So the first one I always ask is, what is a bias that you have? How did you become conscious of it? And how do you challenge it if it needs to be challenged?
A bias that I had was that every male in the world is fucking terrible and a cheater and a liar. So, and I challenge it by recognizing that not every guy in the world is a whore, even though it might be 95% of them. I don't know, but the number is high. But I had to understand that that's me projecting shadow. And after a point, That's no different than being racist or homophobic if I'm going to have a toxic and negative point of view towards every male, because then I'm projecting brokenness from within me. So I had to look at my reflection and go, yeah, I've been hurt by these guys, but there's at least one man in this world who understands the value of his semen and is concerned about where it goes. Might not be a lot of them, but it's got to be a few.
So I love that. And so you're, you know, in terms of how you're challenging it, it sounds like a lot of that challenging of it comes from your own self-reflection and your ability to say, this is, you know, this is what you said, this is me projecting it, you know, it's certainly, if the shoe fits, it'll fit a lot of people perhaps, but not everyone. All right, what are five words that you connect with in this phase of your life?
Well, can I make that 5-7?
Sure.
I pull a line from the John Wick movie series, which is beautiful series. I don't watch that series with anybody else, unless it's my cats. I don't watch Dune, and I don't watch John Wick with humans, period, because they're so highly spiritual to me. It's sacred and special. But my cats are like celestial beings. And so the Japanese boss in John Wick 4 said, "What good is friendship when it's convenient?" When he was sacrificing his life for John Wick. And so that means to me, what good is anything in life when it's easy? You know, this is something that I use to challenge myself. The easy days don't pay as good a dividends as the hard days do. So when my enemies are talking shit against me, wishing that I'm going to fall, when I've had to go through bad things at the hand of lying, cheating, toxic masculine people, or whatever the case may be, that was actually all a blessing. It all helped to push me in the right direction. What I had to do was adjust my perspective. And so when that boss was going to sacrifice his life for John Wick, he said, okay, now is when my friendship counts. What good was it when it was convenient? You know, moving here to New York was hell. You know, my initiation, I spent half the time in the hospital, be it with pneumonia. I had COVID twice, the flu, not to mention the relapsing and the mental health things, all within 4 months. You know, what good would my move here have been had it been convenient? Now that I'm rising up and getting stabilized and everything, I will be a powerful person in New York City, but it's going to mean more since I struggled when I got here.
Okay, most importantly, where should everyone go to find you? Links, social media, website, all the stuff so that they can stay connected.
Sex, drugs, and Jesus.com. And that will link people over to every social media channel, to our YouTube channel, to Down Under Apparel, my retail website, to the blog, to my spiritual classes that I teach and the services that are provided. Literally everything is at that one website.
Okay, perfect. And I also kind of love this idea that we're going to send people to the internet to type in drug, sex, and Jesus. Someone looks at their browser history and they're like, what the hell is happening? I love it. It's so good. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on here and again for staying persistent with me over these 2 years to finally get connected. And I am looking forward to hearing all about your ayahuasca. I'll have to connect with your YouTube, I think you said, that you're going to post it on. So I have to get connected on that because I can't wait to read a bit more about it. But thank you so much for sharing, being transparent, and just being you.
Of course, my dear. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining on another episode of the Breaking Bias podcast. I hope today's episode helped you see a new perspective, gave you some new thoughts on what addiction may or may not look like, and why your assumptions shouldn't matter. I believe that through conversations just like this, we can all set fire to our ignorance and rise from those ashes together as better humans. As a reminder, the thoughts and opinions that were expressed on today's episode, they're our own. We encourage you to do your own research and come to your own conclusions. Please head over to the show notes on links for Devanin. Stay in touch. You'll want to hear his journey. I'm really excited to hear about his experience with ayahuasca, which he's going into, and all other things. For connection with the show, please head on over to our website, which is breakingbiaspodcast.com, where you'll find links to all of our social media and other important resources. If you haven't already, please hit subscribe wherever you're listening now so you never miss an episode. Help us expand our reach by sharing this conversation and our show with others. And until next time, don't forget to check your bias and keep the conversations going.
Mm-hmm.